You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. This week, my guest is two-time Olympic gold medalist and U.S. women's national team soccer legend, Allie Wagner. Allie played for the U.S. women's national team from 1999 to 2008, and over the course of her international career, scored 21 goals and recorded 42 assists. Following her remarkable playing career, Allie brought her passion and tireless work ethic to the broadcast booth and business community. In 2018, Allie made history as the first woman ever to call a men's FIFA World Cup match. And this past summer, she served as the lead analyst for Fox's broadcast of the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup. Now, she's also a co-founding member and co-chair of the National Women's Soccer League expansion team, Bay FC. Allie and Bay FC's founding team secured a record-setting investment from leading global investment firm Sixth Street as the lead institutional investor in Bay FC. Sixth Street made the largest institutional investment to date in a women's pro sports franchise, and Bay FC is set to begin play in 2024. Allie and I recently sat down to explore her journey to the top of the soccer world, how she's reshaping the way soccer broadcasts are delivered to fans today, her plans to turn Bay FC into an iconic global brand, and so much more. This episode is filled with powerful lessons from Allie's work in sports, media, and business that all of us can utilize in our own lives to reach our full potential in absolutely anything. I can't wait for you to hear our conversation. So, let's pull the tarp and get straight to Allie Wagner. Allie, I have had the good fortune of interviewing so many of your U.S. Women's National Team teammates over the years, and I can't wait to dig into your story as well. When Christine Lilly was on this show, she told me this story about orange slices, and she said she was drawn to soccer as a kid because of orange slices at halftime. So I am really curious, what is your first soccer memory, and what drew you to this wonderful game?
First of all, why did I not know that about Lil? Orange slices, that was it? I mean, if I could give orange slices to my daughter and make her fall in love with soccer even more, I would do that in a heartbeat. It was definitely not orange slices for me. Maybe the Capri Sun, but for me, I had an older sister that played. And so again, like times are so different, but when I was growing up, you had to be 5 years old to actually be on a team and play in a competitive environment. And so I was just drawn to it because my big sister played. She was 18 months older. All I wanted to do was be on her team. I was just waiting and waiting and begging my parents for the opportunity to get out there and be in an organized environment where I could actually go out and try to score goals against, you know, another team. So I fell in love with it. I don't know why, at a very early age, probably because I was trying to emulate my sister. But once I got that ball and once I started to feel the game, or maybe it was just straight up competition, because this was my first sport that I played, I was gravitated towards the relationship with the ball and really understanding if I work on this, I can see success. So it just kind of became this snowball effect, this flywheel, where I spent a lot of time with the soccer ball, more so than any of my friends, and was that weird child that was driven for some odd reason, not because I had a goal in mind, but because I loved the relationship that you could have with the soccer ball. I know that sounds really wild. Don't tell my husband.
It sounds wild, but I kind of want to understand it a little bit more, because I guess once we dig into it, it's going to make sense. Relationship with the ball. What, when you say a relationship with the soccer ball, what are you referencing specifically?
Well, it's actually kind of funny, or it's, again, I'm probably going to share too much, but the reality is you could talk to the ball, right? Even when I'm juggling or I would be dribbling, I'd say come here, pelota, or you just get in this space where what you can do to the ball, how you manipulate it, the way you connect with it, the way you spin it, the way that your foot, kind of shapes it, all of that is actually predictable. And I think there's that part that I love, that if I do X, I should expect to get Y. And doing X with consistency, now that's like, that's the training method, right? That's where the beauty of, I think, excellence comes into play. But I think the reality is knowing that if I hit the ball a certain way, I can expect certain results. And I think I like that certainty. I think I like that control, if you will. And that ultimately became kind of like what I'm talking about with my relationship with the ball and allowing the ball to go as I moved up through football and was on a team where now you're playing tactically and you're exploiting space, you know, the ball becomes your best asset. And that if you can put it in the right space with the right spin, the right way to the pass, that opens up the opposition and that creates moments to score goals. Like to me, that ultimately became the artist point of view and what was so intriguing to me about, I think, football that made me want to train harder so I could do everything really consistently well and a predictable outcome, if that makes sense.
Does make sense. I'm curious, Allie, did you recognize immediately that you were incredibly gifted with this ball, or did it take some time?
It's a really interesting question because I did not, like, early on, right? But I knew that I scored 8 goals for my team, and then the other team scored 7 goals, right? So I knew that I was scoring goals really young. But that doesn't mean anything, right? It was just, you're too young to understand it. I just know my parents had told me those stories. I think I recognized that maybe there was, you know, that I was a little bit different, by the way, and the way that I was obsessed with the game and like wouldn't come in for dinner because I want to complete like a task that I set out for myself at a very young age. But when my mom, by the way, gave me this horrific bowl cut haircut, like I look like a little boy, and I was playing up on my sister's team and they were yelling, "Get that boy off the field, get that boy off the field." And part of that was because obviously my horrific haircut, but also because I was actually pretty decent I was little, but they thought that I was actually a boy because I was performing better than the older girls on the field. So I think that's when it kind of became apparent that I was maybe, you know, that I had some potential in this space. But again, let's keep in mind that what we're navigating now for our young kids is very different from what we were going through growing up through the game. And we're so much more evolved now than we were then. So would I be good in this era? That's a question that I actually ask myself all the time. And my answer is probably not as good. No, but my style suits this era much more so than it suited, I would say, our era.
What do you think the biggest difference is today versus when you dove in?
Just the level of instruction, for the most part. Again, there's a lot of bad coaches, but there's a lot of really good coaches. And there's a lot more attention paid to the details. There's a lot more emphasis on the technical side of the game, at least in certain clubs, by the way. I'm not painting a broad stroke and saying this is pervasive across all clubs. I think that there's a lot of really good clubs that do it right, and they're focusing on the technical aspect and developing these plays at such a young age. My daughter's team, for instance, she's 7 years old. Some of these girls are 7, most of them are 8, and they're close to 100 juggles. I got 100 juggles when I was 9. I know it because my goal was to do it before I was 10. And so they're already far beyond where I was in terms of like that technical focus and the emphasis on that relationship with the ball. So I think that's a big component. I think that there's so many more really good players in the space. And ultimately, there's better athletes that are actually getting involved in the women's game. So now that you're partnering that athleticism with the technical development, I think that's where, you know, I think we're going to see the rewards of this work being done in the women's space in 10 years. Because we're a little bit behind now, I would say, you know, at the senior levels, U16 up to our professional or our top team on the global stage. I think we're going to start to see benefits of some of this development in about 10 years. Maybe a little bit sooner, but I would say we have to be patient with ourselves because we're starting to get the right structure in place for these players to be incredibly dominant, I would say, globally.
So, Allie, I've got to ask, you mentioned a couple minutes ago, you're working on your game outside, your parents are calling you in for dinner, and you're just keeping at it. Was that work ethic something that you were born with that just continued to develop over time? Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, right? I have triplet boys that are 10 and a 7-year-old daughter. And I will tell you that in my estimation, work ethic is completely innate. I think it's either something you're born with. Of course, you can train it and craft it to a certain extent. But I think for the most part, it is part of your DNA or it is not. For me, it absolutely was. And I've said this before, but if there was anything I could gift and wish upon anyone else in the world, it would be that work ethic. Because when you look at so many of the people that make it all different facets of life, you talk about business, investing, sports, you name it. Usually that delta, that difference is just that work ethic, that grind, like the ability to appreciate the grind. And I think that's so important for success, and especially in our world now. So yeah, for whatever reason, I was gifted, you know, the ability to suffer. And I think, you know, with that, there's always going to be complications on the other side. But I do think that there's so much value in the ability to set a goal and work hard to actually see it come to fruition. Because at the end of the day, like in broadcasting as well, I mean, the work that I put in is the work that I get out on the other end. And I think that's not a novel concept, but it made, I would say, my journey that much more fruitful because I was able to put in time for the craft, for the details that ultimately make a difference. Winning a game, losing a game, scoring a goal, missing penalties, you name it. Like you can go down the gamut of the qualities that are really important to have as a footballer, as a number 10. And if you are so gifted, like a Messi, that you don't have to work, well, that's a different story. But if you're somewhere in between there, you probably have to grind in order to, I think, rise above.
I've applied that work ethic so well, not only on the pitch, but in the broadcasting studio and in the booth. And now, you know, with the work you're doing with BayFC and all of your other different business ventures, which I can't wait to get into. One other really important skill that I believe everybody needs to succeed is the ability to be humble and the ability to be selfless. Now, I guess you could succeed without it, but it's a lot more fun when you succeed with this mentality of selflessness and a humble spirit. I've heard you say that you enjoyed setting somebody else up on the team for a goal more than kicking it in yourself. Where did that come from? Is that always how it's been?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And by the way, what I'm about to say, I don't know if it's humble or not. So let's pressure test that idea. But always love the beauty of the assist more than the beauty of the goal. In my mind, I do think there is something so incredibly special about providing an opportunity, like a crystal clear opportunity for someone to then go and provide the finishing touch. To me, like, again, the art is in making of the moment and not the moment itself. So that's like where I've always fallen in love with football and soccer in particular, because none of that is scripted, right? In football, like American football, they call the play in, and yeah, you might have a broken play. And that's like where I think the beauty of football can be so, American football can be so intriguing. But for the most part in soccer, like you're dreaming up, you're coming up with these moments, you're creating space, you're manipulating the opponent on the fly. There is no play call that's coming in. And so that to me is like the most interesting part of the game. And as you said, like setting up someone else for that moment is, I think there's so much like internal beauty in that. And so maybe that is humble, maybe it's not, because it's just what I enjoyed more. And it's actually where I think the value of the game is, right? And I know that everyone that builds a team is going to tell me you're crazy because they'll spend their money on a number 9 every day, all day. And that's where they should put their money. Like I would want Haaland on my team as well, right? But the reality is, for me, the most poignant moments in games come in the creation and not the goal itself. So I don't know if that's humble or not, but I'll live by that till my dying day. And to your point, though, on humbleness and serving others, I do think that those are the people you want to hang out with, right? Like those are the people you want on your team. Those are the people that you want in your life. Those are the people that you want to start a business venture with, and the people that are willing to serve something greater than themselves. So when we talk about the success, well, what is success if you don't enjoy the journey? And so I think there's so much to surrounding yourself with people that are actually willing to say, guess what? I'm really bad at this. Like, I could never defend. I was a terrible defender. And so having that self-awareness is really important, and being able to share that and being vulnerable, I think is just, I think it's something that we all find endearing and we want more of it, right? That authentic self. None of us are perfect. We know that.
Absolutely. And you have so much vulnerability that you show, and so much self-awareness. And there's such a, just a thoughtful, cerebral view that you have on football. And I'm curious, was it a natural segue for you from your playing career to the broadcast booth? Was that something that you always wanted to do, that you always knew you'd be really, really effective at? Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, it was not. So it was not on my radar. I think the way that my career ended with injuries was not the way that I wanted it to kind of come to conclusion. And so I really stepped away from football for a while. I didn't watch. I didn't watch the 2012 Olympics, 2011 World Cup. And then I just started to get pulled back in. And when I started to listen to broadcasts, I just realized, I thought that we weren't doing the game justice with a lot of what was being communicated, and that we weren't allowing people to see the beauty of the moments and beauty of the game and the beauty of like what these athletes were actually executing in the moment as much as we could have. And so I kind of started to contemplate it, and I'd be sitting on the couch and I'd say something, and my family was like, you need to go into broadcasting. I was like, what are you talking about? And so a couple of years passed, and Heather Mitz actually reached out to me and asked me, hey, would you have any interest in commentating on the 2015 Women's World Cup? And at that time, I was like, absolutely, I'm in. And then we followed up. They said, oh, there's no opportunity. Well, long story short, like my mentor, Michael Cohen, he was a consultant for Fox at the time. He got me in front of David Neal, got me a tryout. I'd never called a game off of monitor. Like, I had no idea what I was doing. Replays, like, again, you don't know how awkward replays are until you've actually gone through the process of trying to call one and just trying to learn it on the fly in my tryout. And apparently it went well enough and was slotted into the lineup for the 2015 World Cup as kind of team two. And that's when I started to, I think, gravitate towards like, wow, this is something that's exciting. It's awesome. We can shape the game from the booth in a certain way and drive the future of the sport.
Just like you worked towards those 100 juggles as a kid, I also know that your preparation for your broadcast work is relentless, tireless. You watch film for every team that you're going to see in a tournament. Take me through the rest of the process. Is it handwritten notes? Is it on index cards? Do you have a system to organize all this? Just take me through that a little bit. I love the details.
I wish I had a better system. Like, this is where really smart people would step in and say, you are a moron. Like, this should be all digitized, and you should just have folders that pop up that you can go back through history and call up this player. So I'm archaic. Like, I like handwritten notes. I learn visually. And so I have no, I can show you, I have a stack of, I don't know, at this point, it's probably 30 of the Moleskine notebooks, and lined with just team after team notes of games that they played, lineups, player qualities. And then once I go through that process of watching, let's just say about an average of 3 games per team heading into like a world event, then again, that's just like the most recent games. I'll obviously have other context around these teams. Then what I do is I do my rosters. Those are digital. So I have a lot of history and files on that front. So it'll be the name, number, where they're from, age, and then qualities or recent, like you might do all comps, like goals, whatever it is. And so it's all there for the roster component. But then I go through note cards and I pull out of my notes, like basically keys of the game, what I think a manager would think would be keys to the game for this team, strengths, weaknesses, things to consider. Like, what are they going to play a high line? Are they going to press? Are they not? Like, which way are they steering? Who are they trying to steal the ball from? Where's their trap? Where's the trap they're setting? Are they playing direct? Are they skipping midfield? You name it. Like, I'll just have things that I think I should be looking out for because I think it makes sense in this matchup. And then the story becomes, if I see it, or if I don't, why am I not seeing it? What are they doing differently? What did I not anticipate? And try to figure out the why throughout the 90 minutes. So ultimately it comes down to, what did you anticipate? And if you're seeing it, then you can explain the why because you've anticipated it. But if you're not seeing it, that's also a story. And so communicating and trying to figure out the why over the course of the 90 minutes, that becomes, I think, the interesting part with broadcasting on the fly while you're covering highlights, while you're watching, you know, all of those elements roll together. But ultimately, at the end of the day, our job is to explain the why more than the what.
How do you, as a storyteller, because I know telling the story of the players and the game is something you're so passionate about, Allie. How do you kind of figure out what the audience is seeking from a storytelling and a why perspective?
That is such a good question. And everyone has a different opinion on this front, right? So my producers, like Fox, you name it, they'll say, go big picture. Assume that your audience does not know who Erling Haaland is. Assume your audience does not know that, you know, France has never made it to the final of the Women's World Cup. And so they'll say, go big picture and make sure you hit those storylines. But I'm kind of a person that goes, yeah, but I also want to take care of, you know, the astute fan and the person that wants the tactical insight, the tactical nuances. I'm a strong believer in, like, the way I learned football was watching Sunday football with my family, my brother and my dad, American football, I should say. And what they communicated by what they saw is what taught me the game. They didn't dumb it down for me necessarily, or maybe they do, I don't know. But I don't want to dumb it down for the audience. I think the audience is smart enough to figure out what we're saying over time, as long as they start to hear the same patterns, the same language, and they'll start to pick up on all of those incredible details that I think, you know, make soccer so intriguing. So that's part of my view on what the audience wants to hear. And then a lot of times you'll know the big storylines going in. And so even at halftime, sometimes you can check Twitter to see what were people thinking about in that first half. Sometimes I'm like, oh, that's garbage, I'm not addressing it. But sometimes it's like, oh, that's a really good point that they need more information on this front. Or, you know, why is Alex Morgan not getting touches? Could be something as simple as that.
Allie, in addition to the work that you're doing in the broadcast booth and the fantastic career you had on the pitch, you're involved in so many different business ventures. Where I want to go now is Bay FC. You're the co-founder and co-chair of the first NWSL team in the San Francisco Bay Area. I want to make sure I get all the economics right here. So you pitched Sixth Street on investing essentially $125 million, which was the largest institutional investment to date in a women's pro sports franchise. How hard was it to convince them? Because what I remind people, and I've got two young girls, what I remind people is now women's sports is not charity. Women's sports is incredible business, right? Like, let's remember that. But not everybody necessarily understands that. And I'm curious, what was the experience like kind of putting together the investor group? And how did you ultimately sell the idea?
Yeah, so first of all, spot on. And hats off to you for even just communicating that, because that's always been the thesis, right? So I'll go back to, Andrew, for 2018, and we were redoing our house that I'm currently in, and we're living in a rental. And the reason I share that is because that tells me the time frame. I know exactly where I was. And I remember having a conversation with my husband, with my brother-in-law and my father about the idea that the reason women's football, like, is not accelerating right now is merely because the investment is not there. And they don't realize that this is actually good business. I have long been shouting, this is good business. This is not a moral cause. This is not pull at your heartstrings. This is not, like, level the playing field. This is literally good business. And my own family was like, you're crazy, Allie. There's so many smart people in the world. If they saw it as a business opportunity, don't you think they've evaluated? If they saw it as a business opportunity, they would have already invested in it. And I felt obviously very strongly. The night didn't end so well, but move flash forward, you know, to 2 years later, COVID happens. And we start to drum up this idea of bringing an NWSL team to the Bay Area, because Angel City, what their launch looked like, it was so incredibly successful and impactful. And the only way I was hesitant because the only reason I actually wanted to get involved in the NWSL was to prove the thesis that we can actually build a global brand, one that can stand shoulder to shoulders with the top men's brands across different sports, Yankees, Real Madrid, Barcelona, you name it. I believe that to be where we're headed. I believe that's the future of what women's sports will look like. And hopefully we'll be the first one to achieve that, status. Nonetheless, going through the process of lining up the investors, we had a really smart group around us initially. They were tech execs in the Bay Area, super smart. We did it, right? So we did a seed round, a series A, series B. When we got to the part where we needed our lead investor, that's when we started to have the conversation with Sixth Street. And Alan Waxman, who's CEO, co-founder of Sixth Street, he did get the thesis. He understood it immediately. They'd been investing in sports, investing in soccer, and he understood that this was a very undervalued property and that the trends with, you know, what we're looking at with the access through social media, through the ability to have a massive reach through digital means, over the top networks with, or direct to consumer, you name it, broadband, like the barriers to entry or to access our product, those were being removed. And so now the market is going to drive basically the business model. And so he got it. And it really was not a hard sell to get them to understand the thesis. Because again, Alan is probably like 10 steps ahead of everyone else in the world. Incredible investor. Very bright. And then it just became about coming together, pulling the investors together, and actually winning that expansion bid with our thesis, with our proposition of what we could do in the Bay Area.
In the expansion bid, I'm curious, Ali, obviously you have so many talents, but there has to be some surprises along the way, right? Like, could you point to one thing so far that, in spite of all your talents, like you couldn't anticipate or has been a bigger challenge than you would have thought it would be on the business side of this?
Yeah, I think first and foremost, just the timeline. I mean, I think we knew it. So you're saying it was, you know, not anticipated. This was anticipated, but it's actually even more condensed than we realized. By the time we were granted the expansion bid and the short runway that we had for 2024 season, imagine our players are checking in basically end of January, beginning of February. And that is a very short runway to stand up a company, bring on partners, have a training facility, have a game facility, have everything in place for these players to walk into to a really incredible experience. That's just flat out a time pressure that is real. And we knew, but it was condensed even further than we anticipated. I think one thing that I'm witnessing as we're going through it is setting up a culture. We're literally building a company from the ground up. And we know what the vision is. We know what we want it to be, but maintaining like that initial integrity of it and keeping the culture exactly how we're going to want it as we staff out. Like, I've never gone through that process. So everyone that's built a business is like, yeah, of course, Ali, that's obvious. I didn't expect that. I didn't anticipate that as being something that we actually had to actively, proactively be on top of. I think when you're thinking about just this, again, it, standing up a company, that's one thing. We actually have to put a team together. Like, we need players, we need a coach. And there's only a certain amount of windows in the international market that you can actually go and bring these players into your squad and build your team out. So that's another challenge. There is just so many dynamics to the situation that are wild, that are crazy. Making sure our training facility is ready on time. Again, it comes down to the time pressure, I think, more than anything. And so will the first year be perfect? No. It won't be, but I don't think anyone would expect it to be. But will we be hopefully killing it by, you know, year five? If we're not, then we're doing something wrong. So we got to be a little bit patient.
Ali, aside from the work ethic, which we talked about a lot, and you said you were gifted with remarkable work ethic and ability to outlast suffering, I guess is the way you had put it. What skill set would you say you are utilizing the most in this phase of your career? Not necessarily the broadcasting, but the business building side. Like, what skill do you think is you're using most and is most critical?
Wow, that is a really good question. I think resilience is probably the most important factor that is helping navigate this process. Because as you said, there's just so many trip ups along the way that you just quite honestly couldn't see coming. I think being able to, in your career, right? You can have setbacks in soccer career. You can have setbacks. You can have things that don't go as expected. But those are usually like longer, right? There, you see it coming. It's unless it's an injury, but then it's a longer process to get back. And so they don't happen as often. I think as you're standing up a business and you're a part of this organization that now is marching towards a deadline, things can happen just in parallel. They can happen sequentially. They can happen one day after the other. There's just so much that there is to navigate that you have to be resilient from day to day, from week to week, because you're just going to be hit from different sides with things that you just honestly didn't expect. And, you know, for me as a strong personality, someone that's kind of a little bit more type A than not, I think being able to be patient, recognize and have the self-awareness for like what I've done right, what I've done wrong, all of that is playing into this theory of resilience and ultimately just trying to stay the course and play towards the long game.
Play towards the long game, yeah. Flex that resilience muscle. Yeah. Allie, this has been so much fun. I feel like we're going to have to connect again in a year or two and see where Bay FC continues to go. I know you are going to build that global brand, just like you built an incredible field, an incredible career for yourself on the pitch, and an incredible second career for yourself in the broadcast booth. This has been so much fun. U.S. Women's National Team stars never disappoint when I get a chance to sit down and talk about your careers and your journeys. Allie Wagner, you are no different. All right. Thank you so much. You're forever part of the Everybody Pulls the Tarp community.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Andrew. And by the way, we're going to get you out to game, whether you come to California or in Washington. You're coming out when Bay is playing.
I cannot wait for that, Allie.
Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of tarp pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today is a great day to pull the tarp. I am rooting for you. See you next time.